From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2015 when the Oregon Shakespeare Festival announced it had asked 36 playwrights to translate all of Shakespeare's plays into modern English. As reported by The New Yorker, the backlash was immediate. Shakespeare purists unloaded their criticism on this decision on the festival's Facebook page, saying, among other things, quote, "What a revolting development. Is there really a need to translate English into brain-dead American? Why not just rewrite Shakespeare in emoticons and text acronyms?" End quote. Columbia University English professor James Shapiro attempted to explain the outrage. He told Oregon Public Broadcasting, quote, "Shakespeare is about the intoxicating richness of the language. It's like the beer I drink. I drank 8.2% IPA, and by changing the language in this modernizing way, it's basically shifting it to Bud Light. Bud Light is acceptable, but it just doesn't pack the punch and the excitement and the intoxicating quality of that language," end quote. Others disagree, saying Shakespeare's language needs sobering or tweaking in order to make it more accessible and engaging, especially for younger audiences. They argue that the canon is reflected in more modern works, and those can be used to teach the themes and storylines of the original plays. And they say that to adapt to modern issues, ideas, debates, and include diverse choices and perspectives, well, the work should be discussed or performed in new ways. What do you think? How should we teach the classics? Does it have to be exactly the language that was first on the page? Can it be that language but mixed with modern ideas? Can we bring it into some sort of a pop culture context? Or does that mar the source material? Our guests this hour are here to have a little fun with this question. Sheila Byrne is an advanced placement English teacher at Webster Thomas High School. She was giving me a lesson before the program began about how Breaking Bad has elements of
Frankenstein. It has elements of Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
Yes.
Look at that. Hey, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And Don Burns is on the line with us, an English teacher and a Darth Vader for Garrison Excelsior, 501st Legion, who is working on a film. Don, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon.
What does Darth Vader for Garrison Excelsior mean?
I am Darth Vader for the 501st Legion. We go to events all over the state and sometimes all over the country in Star Wars costumes, and we raise money and awareness for charities and also spread our love for Star Wars.
I have seen the short film here. We'll be talking about that. Is that you in the Darth Vader costume there?
That is me.
That's you. Don, welcome.
Yeah.
Don, Darth Vader is with us. You know, there's a lot of ways we can go with this, but I want to make it clear to the audience. We want sort of a range of perspectives here, and we're not here to sort of denigrate anybody's ideas about what you like or what you don't like. I think it's a question of what makes the classics, and whether they can be sort of massaged into different directions or blended, whether it's with pop culture or even reworded. I mean, so there's different ideas here. Sheila, you seem on board with some ideas, but carefully resistant to other parts of these ideas here. Tell me about how you approach this in class.
So in our school in ninth grade, students normally read Romeo and Juliet. And they read an edition that's called No Fear Shakespeare, which has the original text side by side with a more adapted modern language, so that if students become unfamiliar with the text, then they can look at kind of like the modern translation. And in ninth grade, I think that's appropriate because you're reading Shakespeare for the first time in school. But by the time you're in AP Lit in your senior year, you should be able to decode that or kind of get the cadence of it. And so sometimes that's appropriate. There's a whole nother world out there in Spark Notes where you can just get the summaries. And that is, So I usually,
I'm sorry.
We've blocked those in our school.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So thank you to the tech department for blocking Spark Notes on our students' Chromebooks. And, the other thing is that most of the time I will print out, if we're reading a difficult text like Frankenstein, the seniors in my classes right now are reading Frankenstein and they're not loving it because it was written in the mid 1800s and they like the story behind it. sometimes they'll say, I can't believe a 17-year-old or a 19-year-old girl wrote this. And I said, well, 19-year-old girls were a lot different back then. But the text itself can be kind of dense. And so I will sometimes print out the Spark Notes so that they can see what was left out. So when I print out the translation, they have to tell me why this matters.
Are Spark Notes like Cliff Notes?
Yes.
I mean, I always thought Cliff Notes' slogan should have been helping kids discover the magic of not reading since 1985.
Pretty much, yeah. One student told me, one spark, many notes. That's how you remember it.
But at the same time, it seems to me that you think it's valuable to keep that source material and not just give a pure modernization of whether it's Frankenstein, Shakespeare, or otherwise.
I think it's appropriate in performance, because in any iteration of Shakespeare, there's always going to be an interpretation that is performance-based. For example, Sir Patrick Stewart did a version of Macbeth where they were dressed in Weimar Republic costumes, and it was about that kind of war. And there's other interpretations. There's the infamous Leonardo DiCaprio, Romeo and Juliet, which I'm not a huge fan of. And it's about engaging students in the story, but it's also about them engaging them in performance. So I've found the best way to do that is to actually have them perform it. So when we read Julius Caesar, they have to put togas on. I mean, they're bed sheets that I got at a garage sale, but they're togas. And I finally perfected the art of having everybody sit in a circle when Caesar is stabbed, and they have to read. They have to be the crowd. They have to get the emotional intensity. So I think that Shakespeare in performance is different than Shakespeare reading it. Someone told me once that Shakespeare was not meant to be read. It was meant to be performed. So that leaves a lot of room for interpretation.
And you talk about Breaking Bad as an example of sort of a modern-day Frankenstein. So you are on the lookout for what's sort of popular and ties to some of these historical analogs. What is the Breaking Bad analog to Frankenstein?
So we talked a lot about that Victor Frankenstein is creating this creature, and he's invested so much of himself into it that when it actually comes to life, he doesn't know what to do, and he rejects it. And so we called that the monster within and the monster without. So who created that monster? The monster was born innocent, and it's that old nature versus nurture thing. And actually, I can't take credit for that idea about Breaking Bad, because one of my students wrote an essay about it for his final project, and he said that Walter White was an example of someone who created a monster, and the monster was him. And so, because if you've read Frankenstein, spoiler alert, and also if any of my students are listening, spoiler alert, you know that Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein the doctor, becomes the monster because he has neglected and rejected his creation. And he's created it without a plan. So the same kind of thing happens with Walter White. He becomes less and less himself and more the monster. So
I suspect that student got a good grade on that one.
He did. It was a really good essay, and it was well written and supported. So he asked beforehand if he could use Breaking Bad, and I said, well, tell me about what you want to write. And he explained it to me, and it was a really good idea about how little by little his family drops away and he loses his friends and he becomes obsessed with this alter ego. And so this was the year of the finale, the season finale, and I have not watched all of Breaking Bad, but it also is connected through Ozymandias, the poem, and the penultimate episode.
Sheila, all you got to watch is the scene where Walter White says, "I am the one who knocked."
Yes.
Yeah. It's a powerful transformation that we're seeing. So cheers to your students for that. I think that's fascinating. But that doesn't mean that you said, well, we're not going to do Frankenstein, or we're not going to read the original material, right? So it's kind of doing both.
Yeah. Yes, they had to read the original material because there's a cadence to an original text that gives you an idea of how people spoke and thought. For example, if you're reading The Scarlet Letter, which is universally despised in 11th grade, AP English.
Is it really?
They hate it.
The students do.
Yes. Yeah. So you either read The Crucible or you read The Scarlet Letter. And usually AP students read The Scarlet Letter. But I normally have between 50 and 60 AP 11 students. And out of those students, I have maybe two or three students that liked it. And the rest of them are just like, this is awful. And so
just because the prose is so dense, it's dry.
Yes.
I mean, do they not get it or what's the issue?
They get it. But for example, there's one passage where they're describing Hester Prynne is going to the governor's to plead her case so that she can keep her child. And they get to the governor's and they notice that the native plants are taking over this cultivated garden that they've tried to kind of imitate from where they left England. And so I said, you know, I call it the symbolism mallet of Nathaniel Hawthorne. I said, what is this show? It shows that the things in America are taking over from England. It's a very symbolic way of showing the pumpkin vines are overtaking the roses and things like that. And that they like. And also anything you can link to, like, the seven deadly sins, or we do a thing where when they're walking back to the village, they meet seven people. And this is Reverend Dimmesdale. He meets seven people, and I say, each of those represents the seven deadly sins. How does that work? And that's part of this is just engaging them in the text, because there's a real challenge in getting students to read difficult texts. It's not easy when they are into Percy Jackson or Harry Potter. One of my students actually said this yesterday. They said, if you let us read whatever we wanted to, it would be nothing but Harry Potter and Percy Jackson and Stephanie Plum. And I said, good to know, because you're reading none of those in AP English class.
Yeah, yeah. And before I bring Don in here for his thoughts on this, one other point that Sheila was making for the program, as an AP English teacher at Webster Thomas High School, you engage with your students about why you've chosen certain material. And that didn't happen when I was in school. It was, here's what's assigned, hope you get it, and hence the explosion of Cliff Notes. why do you think it's important to tell kids why you want them to read certain material?
I think that if students know that there's an objective to reading this book, that it helps them to understand that this isn't just some random assignment that they're being given, some random book, and the only reason that you're reading it is because the English teacher told you so.
And wants to torture you.
Exactly. So if I wanted to torture them, they could read The Scarlet Letter. So when we read Shakespeare, we contextualize it. So one of my colleagues used to read Othello every year with 10th graders, and he would say, have you ever had a friend that stabbed you in the back or betrayed you, or you knew that they weren't really a good person, but you kind of relied on them anyway? And so starting with a good opening question. So with Frankenstein, we talk about all this, like, CRISPR technology and gene splicing, gene therapies, all the things that are being, like, even the coronavirus, what mutations mean, mm-hmm. what happens when you create something in a lab. And so it does give them context for what's happening in a book that was written a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. And frankly, with The Scarlet Letter, every time it's been modernized, every time it's become a movie, the focus is on the sex. The focus is on, you know, this unstoppable sexual chemistry between Dimmesdale and what's her name?
Hester
Prynne, of course.
Yes.
Which I suppose that's what sells movie tickets. But what you're focusing on, at least in this conversation, is not just the sex, but it's the really interesting themes that without help, they might not realize, oh, those are the seven deadly sins that are represented
yes.
here. That's interesting. Or look at the way the pumpkins are overtaking the roses. What does that mean? That's not just the sex, I guess.
Well, and that's part of being an English teacher, is that in AP Lit, they usually give you a list of books, and you're going to write an essay about one of them at the end of the test. And so it says, choose any book from this list or a similar book of literary merit. So we have to talk about what has literary merit. Like a Stephanie Plum book, super, super engaging, interesting, fun to read, but it exists for the plot and the characters. There's no, I haven't ever found any symbolism in Stephanie Plum books, or, I mean, I actually was thinking about the Bourne series of books because I was listening to a podcast and they compared Jason Bourne to Victor Frankenstein, which I thought was really interesting. Just kind of being obsessed with doing one thing and rejecting your country, rejecting your family, and just to go off and get revenge. And so the reason that we read this is because I always have a reason. There's always a reason. And there's something that I want them to see. I'm not going to tell them what the book means because no, there has never been a student in the history of the world that wanted their teacher to tell them what the book meant, because it starts, I think, with Lord of the Flies, when someone will say, well, the conch shell represents this and the glasses represent that. And kids will say, what? Wait, what? What? No. And so then you get into an argument with students, which is not what you want to do. I would rather hear them debate. I think this means this. Show me how I'm wrong.
Yeah, or, support the argument.
Yeah. So part of it is having an opinion about the book. So you have to engage everybody. Mm-hmm. And part of it is knowing your audience, too. If you have, so this year we have, our students have had 2 years of kind of on and off instruction as far as language and analysis and choosing books because of the COVID shutdowns. So that's why I didn't assign the Scarlet Letter, because I knew that it was going to be really daunting for some students, and I didn't want them to become discouraged about trying to tackle a tougher text. So we'll tackle a tougher text later in the year after I feel like I've kind of brought them along a little bit.
Don, how do you see the challenge of sparking interest, respecting the classics, but finding ways that will keep them engaged?
Well, not too much of an opposing viewpoint here. I agree with everything that was said already. Basically, I like to try to bring in references that are in today's movies to back to the classics, such as like The Lion King is essentially Hamlet. Lion King 1.5 is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, which isn't a classic, but it's kind of neat to point out. But and just things like that that are already in movies. And I try to keep the, when the kids see where the material comes from, it usually kind of gets them a little bit more interested into it.
Lion King is an interesting example because that's another one that, I mean, I guess I should be smart enough to already know this, but I don't. Does that surprise some students, Don, when you start drawing those parallels?
It absolutely shocks them, because when there's kind of like this snobbery with especially Shakespeare, where people think it's one thing, and when they think that it's all, you have to have the language and all that. And while I do believe the language is what makes Shakespeare Shakespeare, but once they realize the story underneath, it gets more accessible. And that's why I agree also that it has to be performed. I show multiple performances of each scene to show the differences of what different actors do. And then ultimately in the end, it's up to the student to come up with what they think in the end.
When you think about Star Wars, for example, I mean, you are Darth Vader for the Garrison Excelsior, Don, 501st Legion, and you know, you created about a 6-minute film that puts Darth Vader using the language from Macbeth. Is the Star Wars story itself, is it Shakespearean?
It was rooted in a myth. And that's what George Lucas was big on Joseph Campbell's teachings back in the 60s, and he rooted Star Wars in myth, and he borrowed from a whole bunch of different places. And it's funny because when people say that the classics are there and you can't touch them, Shakespeare himself was borrowing from classics at his time. During his time, he borrowed a lot from the folklore that was back then. Romeo and Juliet was based on a epic poem that was before him. All the histories, he basically rewrote history to fit his plays, and it was all about the story for Shakespeare. And so I think it's the story itself that is what pushes the classics to still be around today.
Well, and
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I mean I'm thinking about the way that we contextualize a lot of these kind of conversations into, understandably, right now. So the assumption is maybe that I have, and maybe that some listeners have, that, well, Don and Sheila and teachers are faced with this dilemma. How do we get students to engage? Because Shakespeare was always popular, but now kids aren't all that into it. And the New Yorker has noted that changing elements of Shakespeare's plays used to be common practice. Quoting from Daniel Pelsner's piece, quote, "These days we tend to assume that productions can change anything about Shakespeare, the setting, the period, the character's race or gender, as long as the script stays mostly intact. Cut or reordered, perhaps, but not rewritten entirely. This is a fairly recent notion. Until the late Victorian era, stage performances usually observed the setting and period implied in the play, but they transformed the language. Shakespeare's script was the first problem that a production had to remedy," end quote. So this isn't all, I guess, a common or a recent historical debate, Don, which maybe gives some comfort to the idea that if you want to pair Shakespeare with Star Wars, or you want to spend some time finding the elements of Frankenstein in Breaking Bad, that, well, teachers and performers have been doing this kind of thing for much longer than we've been here. Does that add some comfort for teachers, Don?
Well, yes, because what Sheila said earlier about reading books and no students wants to have the answers. Every single person, when they read a book, we all can read the same book and we all have we take away something different from it, from our own life experiences. And that's what the stories behind the good stories actually push that notion. And with changing, just for the time period, changing Shakespeare plays, I think it was after World War II where The Merchant of Venice, Shylock became the centerpiece of that play. And 12th Night with Antonio and I can't remember his benefactor's name. It was last hundred years where they were showing like a homosexual relationship between the two. And then Antonio goes and tries to get Viola's hand, I believe it was. I haven't read that in a while, I'm sorry. But these, I'm good with ideas and not good with names. And that's why, for me, I'm more about the story. And that's what I try to teach with the students. And that's what stays with you. Because when you think back to things, you don't think about the characters and what the plays meant. You think about the scenes that really affected you. And if I can get a student to feel that, that I did my job as a teacher, and I think that's what keeps the classics around, those stories that really hit you, and dense language or not, in the end has some kind of redeeming quality in there that stays with you as you get older and you mature with it.
Talking to Don Burns and Sheila Byrne, no relation, the names are not even the same, but they're both English teachers, and we're talking about teaching the classics. And I want to start working in some feedback, so if you're on the phone, hang there for 1 second. I just want to read a note from a listener who describes themselves as a huge classics purist. So let me read this this listener's feedback. "I won't even read contemporary English translations of 19th century Russian novels because it somehow feels wrong to read Dostoevsky or Tolstoy in modern English. The people of their time just wouldn't talk like that, and it takes away the texture of the era, which I think is the most edifying part of reading the classics in general, to step into a world and explore a different historical landscape. I think there's so much that you can learn about the development of culture and society from reading books in the way that the author intended them to be read. By jazzing up novels to make them more approachable to contemporary students, you're pulling them away from their history, and you're taking away a key element that makes them a classic in the first place. Sure, prose can be difficult from the Victorian era for students. The sentences can seem too long. Some people don't really want to read about a daisy-filled meadow for 7 pages. But by altering the prose, you're taking away the chance for students to fall in love with a style of writing and a way of being that is both vastly different and surprisingly similar to the world of their own," end quote. What do you think, Don?
I would agree with that, but at the same time, authors are, they use the words to create their craft. Like Shakespeare, nobody talked like that back in Shakespeare's time. He wrote in poetry. Shakespeare himself coined 3,000 words, I believe, just to fit the iambic pentameter in this and his poetry. So, again, Shakespeare was using all the tools they had on the story, and he used the poetry to as a vehicle to tell his story, and the words are probably better than anybody in the history of English ever has ever done. That's why it's still around. But yes, but if you keep it at the place where you're too worried about the language and you don't get the feeling across, you could lose a whole generation of readers. If you don't know what's going to spark the student. And what's funny about Shakespeare and is when I teach it, it's funny the students that I connect with that. The kids that I usually teach it somewhere in the middle of the year, and the kids that's in the back and haven't turned in anything all year, all of a sudden are starting to do their homework and they're starting to write essays about it. And it's always those students that make the connections. They don't understand why. But it's, again, it's just the connection that you have with the story.
What do you think, Sheila? What would you say to this listener?
So I think that going off of what Don just said, I think that it's interesting to mention poetry because that's something that we never do this to. We never take Walt Whitman and change it into modern language. We never take sonnets and change them into modern language. And the poetry of language, what your listener said is correct. There is poetry in language, but if you're going to use Russian literature, I would say some of that is lost in translation. That's a whole nother issue. But the poetry of Shakespeare, the rhymed couplets, we spend a lot of time doing sonnets, and the poetry of Walt Whitman, the poetry of other poets from days gone by, like Browning, or even contemporary poet like Yusuf Kumanyika, no one is going to translate that. That's the point of poetry. So if we looked at classical literature like we looked at poetry, there'd be, I mean, there are spark notes for poetry, but it just tells you basically what the poem was about. It doesn't give you the emotions. It doesn't give you the richness, the experience of reading it. And I think what your listener said about, or maybe it was Don, about losing a generation, that's really important. And so I look at this almost like when you have a young child and you're getting them used to eating solid food, you don't give them a steak. You give them stuff that's kind of mushed up and easy to swallow. And so it's the same thing with classical literature. You have to introduce it in a way that is palatable and is digestible for students so that when they start reading it on their own, that they will have a real enthusiasm for it. And I had a student who, after we read Song of Myself by Walt Whitman, which is a pretty long poem, and it's very dreamy and ethereal and American. And after class, she came up and said, that just changed my life. And that student is now a teacher. So I feel like that is something that when you get that passion for literature, it's almost like you kind of have to be a teacher so you can carry that on.
Well, speaking of, Evie in Brighton is a teacher and wants to weigh in on some of what she's hearing. Hi, Evie, go ahead.
Hi, Evan. I'm going to try not to contradict myself because there's so many things to say. So I'm an English teacher. I love Shakespeare. I love classical literature. I love the canon. I love the new stuff, too. I just love the art of literature. And so I think that as an art, we need to respect it for what it is. So, for example, watching a Shakespeare play is not the same as reading a Shakespeare play. Reading a Shakespeare play is not the same as studying a Shakespeare play. So if we're talking about what we're doing in school, we're really studying this, right? And nobody, on one hand, nobody's talking about burning Shakespeare books, right? Like, we're keeping the original. So if you're interested in studying the era, if you're interested in studying the language, you will obviously go to the original to study those things. So we're talking about offering other options that might make the transition to Shakespeare, the gateway to Shakespeare a little bit easier for some kids who are reluctant. I'm not sure that there's anything wrong with that, but we have to be careful, I think, not to say that we're going to recreate the Shakespeare play. We're going to create something new. And maybe if we treat it as something that will be useful you know, in introducing Shakespeare. Cool. Or maybe we really like the story that Shakespeare offered here, and so we'd like to retell it in other ways. We just have to recognize it's not going to be the same story. Hamlet's first line is, who's there? Right? How are you going to translate that? It means, you know, I think it's a challenge to the reader, right? It's who are you? It's an invitation to be introspective and to look into yourself. But of course, it's also asking, who am I dealing with? What is this around me? Who can I trust? It's also telling us it's so pitch black out that I can't even see somebody whose footsteps I can hear right in front of me. So there are 10 different things going on with that line. Which one are we going to choose to translate into modern English? You know, and are we okay with losing, you know, the 7 other plots that that line also implies? And I think that's really important. And I think that if kids are not getting into it, it's not because the story is irrelevant. The classics have remained because they are relevant, because the human nature hasn't changed in all these ways. These stories are about us. And I think if we can show the students that Shakespeare is speaking to you when he says, who is there? And if we can understand that Frankenstein is you, right? And it's also, you know, your teacher, and it's also your dad, and it's also your little brother, like, and it's the character in your favorite movie, and it's the protagonist in your favorite song. Those are all Frankenstein. You know, then these classics can become relevant. And as one of your guests was saying, that's what makes all the difference. If they can see the relevance, why are we reading this? What does it have to do with me? Then they will love it and they will connect to it. And everybody's going to want to be an English teacher.
But what do you say, Evie, when a student says to you, this is boring or I don't get it?
Right. So come to me at lunch, right? And let's look at that line. And I'm going to tell you what makes me love it, what I hear in it, and what it says to me, and what it makes me think of about my life and about my job and about my relationship with you. And I take objection to this notion that, you know, what the author meant. You know, we're not going to ask Shakespeare what he meant. And I think I love him and I respect him enough to say he meant all of it, everything. Whatever you get out of that line, that's what he meant. What a book means, what a poem means is the way it changes you, the way it makes you grow, the way it makes you develop, the way it makes you realize and recognize something. That's what that means. I'm not about to tell anybody that. SparkNotes is certainly not about to tell anybody what Shakespeare meant. And if they do, that's really limiting, and that's really, I think we lose a ton if we start treating great works of art that way.
I appreciate the insight, as always. Thank you. By the way, are you finding that students dread some of the classics, or do you turn some around, Debbie? Do you have people kind of leaving class after a quarter or a year going, you know, that was good stuff, I get it, or I'm excited about it?
I mean, I would love to say that, yes, I turn it around for all of them. I'm not that naive after 20
no
years.
No teacher has ever done it for all of them.
But I think what makes me reach some of the students that I reach is how much I love the stuff that I teach and how honest I am with them about being excited about this line or that line, you know, and how I just had an epiphany about this over here and I've never seen this before, you know, and giving them assignments that make them draw those connections, make them connect what is happening to Hamlet with what is happening to you this afternoon. And there are those connections. That's why we still read Shakespeare, because he's talking about the same stories that we're living. I'm convinced of that.
Great stuff, as always. Thank you, Evie.
Thank you, Evan.
Evie in Brighton is an English teacher. And let me ask our guests if they want to add to that. What did you make? I saw you nodding a lot there, Sheila.
Well, I agree, because you can read the same play, and many of us do. We read the same play every year or every other year if we alternate. And I had an epiphany about a line in Julius Caesar, "The fault is not in our stars, dear Brutus. It is in us that we are underlings." And so I started thinking about all the meanings of the word fault. And I, when you're reading it with a group of students and you have one of those moments, it makes you so enthusiastic. And it brings your students into the world of appreciating it. And that kind of, it's contagious. So even if everybody doesn't love it, at least they're in on it. And I think that is also something to note as well.
By the way, do you have students say, hey, we should read The Fault in Our Stars?
Oh, yeah.
John Green's book. No,
some students will say, that's like that book, The Fault in Our Stars. And I'm like, that's where he got the title.
The title came from Shakespeare.
Yeah. And then we have a big talk about archetypes, which is kind of like what we're talking about with Star Wars, like, and Joseph Campbell, the whole archetypal thing, and I usually say that classic literature is the original stories and everything else is derivative.
Don Burns, anything you want to add here?
Well, Wanda, I think I mentioned this to you in an email. Over the summer, my kids got hooked on this Fairies movie, I think it was called, and I was sitting there watching it. It seemed really familiar. And I said, hey, this is, what was it? Much Ado About Nothing. No, it wasn't. Oh, geez. I forget the title. I'm sorry. But
Midsummer's Night Dream.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you. And I went and I pulled out my Shakespeare book with my 10 and 12-year-old, and we sat there and read Midsummer's Night Dream, and they stuck with it because of the movie, and they stopped me a bunch of times saying, hey, that's what happened in the movie. So, again, the different tellings of these stories can spark. And so I have to agree with that there, too. So.
Well, it's a great conversation, and I have a ton of feedback. So if you're on the phone or if you've sent an email, we're going to take our only break of the hour, and we're just going to rip through the feedback as we think about teaching the classics, teaching Shakespeare, reaching people, often kids, students who feel like it's not for them or they don't get it or they're bored by it. How much can we change here? How much can we alter? How much can we find a way to bring into their world? And there are creative ways to do that without losing the source material, as Don Burns and Sheila Byrne, Evie on the phone, so many are explaining to us. Let's take this break, and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, Wine Enthusiast Magazine chooses an annual winemaker of the year from around the world. Their choice this year is Fred Merworth from Herman J. Wehmer in the Finger Lakes. We talked to Fred about what the honor means for him in the region. In our second hour, Tap and Mallet in Rochester is closing, an institution for 14 years. We'll talk about its legacy. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Miriam in Geneseo next on the phone. Hi, Miriam. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been thinking about so many things. I'm going to try to make them articulate. I'm a sign language interpreter, and I have interpreted a lot of poetry and stories and novels and stuff in classes that I worked for years in university settings. And the question always is form over function, right? Like, if you're teaching classics to kids, I know that you really want the language to be preserved because there's, as you said, the history, the culture, all the things that are embedded in language. But if the point is to have them connect with universals like archetypes or what our legacy is, what the canon is. And you're fighting a losing battle right now with all the media, like to put a line in the sand and say, well, I really don't want a watered down version. I really don't want to do something in modern language because, you know, that really just adulterates the text too much. Then that's sort of, it's a little bit too late to the party. But I think if the point is the function of it, you can teach it in whatever language that you think is accessible to them and then go back later once they understand it. I mean, as a sign language interpreter, I can't even, you know, I take the text and then I have to make something visual out of it. And if there's a play on words or there's these really clever things that happen within the language, I can either try to find a corollary in sign or, you know, maybe I won't be able to because you lose something in translation. Robert Frost very famously said, poetry is what gets lost in translation. So, but what you try to do is find what the point of it is. And then, you know, if somebody wants to explore the original language of it, that it was written in. I mean, we can't all read original texts of other languages. Nobody's saying, like, if you don't read Proust unless you understand French. Don't read Dostoevsky unless you understand Russian. There have to be translations. And there's the last thing I want to say is that there's an idea you're probably very familiar with called ekphrasis. And ekphrasis is a piece of artwork that's created inspired by another artwork. And when I do translations of texts for performances or for whatever, I feel like not only am I doing a translation, but I'm doing something that in this other language and in this other modality could stand as its own sort of piece. I don't want to, you know, elevate myself like some great artist, but it stands as its own translation and it stands as a piece of art itself because I can't use the same language. I can't even, as an interpreter, use the same modality of text or spoken word. It's something that goes on in my hands and my body, and it's an embodied condition kind of thing. So I'm sorry, I went kind of all over the place in lots of directions, but it's a wonderful conversation.
Oh, no, Mary, I am so grateful. Such a great point, and thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for bringing these ideas to the program. So just to sort of build on what Miriam had to say there, First of all, on the notion that Frost brought up that poetry is what's lost in translation, sometimes we don't even need to translate something and meaning gets lost. Robert Frost wrote the most famous poem in history, The Road Not Taken. It's not about bold choices. It's a poem about the way we look back at our lives and convince ourselves that we made bold choices. But hey, people have taken it to mean something that Frost didn't even intend. So, but I think Miriam's point is so important here. You think about sign language. What's the message with Shakespeare in sign language? You can't do things a certain way, or you have to stick to it. I totally get the love and devotion to the source material. And I totally get the idea that some people have that if you change it, you lose some of it, or you lose all of it, or you lose a big part of it. But I also feel like not everyone has that bell to ring. I don't really have it within me to be a great chemist. Like, there's nothing you could do to make me a great chemist. I'd like you to introduce me as a student, as my teachers did, to some of the great concepts of science. And just for me, it wasn't there. So I did my best. I worked hard. I appreciate it. But that wasn't there. Whereas the first time you hear Shakespeare, if you're a student, you may have it within you that that's a bell that's ringing, that you're going, wow, there is something beautiful and mystifying and really interesting and riveting about this. And you want more of it, but you need help getting there. And I don't think there's anything wrong with needing help getting there, or needing a translation, or needing something to kind of make it accessible. Because eventually, Sheila, maybe your students say, hey, you've helped me, but now I'm a purist myself. Now I'm a Shakespeare junkie. Does that happen?
That does happen. But I would always like to say that I wonder if Miriam made it to the Highland Park Shakespeare in the Park this past summer, where they did two sets of actors performing The Tempest. One set of actors were signing and the other set were speaking. And it was one of the most wonderful performances awesome. I had ever seen of The Tempest. And it does... You do have to make it accessible if students don't understand it, the concepts and the ideas. But I would also say some students prefer to be purists. I do have a couple students that are interested in Jane Austen or the Brontes, and that's their thing. And hopefully they'll continue with that. So we do try to give students choices, especially with difficult literature. In the past, I know one of my colleagues has offered students a choice of Romantic era literature. So they can read a Bronte, they can read Frankenstein, they can read Oscar Wilde. They get to pick. So being able to understand it and then having a choice of what you want to read, I think it really is powerful in understanding those concepts.
And Sheila, Jonathan writes to us to say, to be timeless is to be relevant. And much of the re-envisioning has to do with decades, maybe centuries, of aligning the truths of the human condition that Shakespeare captured with a solely white or European gaze and a solely white or European audience. Do these truths hold up when the protagonists aren't white or male or binary? Can these truths exist in today's world or on an animated East African savanna? Plus, if a purist truly existed, they'd believe only in no women on stage, doubled roles, and the cheap seats being the ones right in front of the stage. That's from Jonathan. Great points there, aren't they?
It is a good point, and this is something that we have to recognize. There's a new version of Macbeth that is coming out with Denzel Washington as Macbeth. Now, that is much different from Sir Patrick Stewart's version of Macbeth, but I think it's going to be more accessible. It's also, there was a theater troupe from far up north Alaska that did Antigone, and some of the Greek classics performed in their native tongue as in their native dress, and that was a big hit. I lived in Alaska for a while, and so that was always really popular when they came into town to do their performances. I think that I would offer that Shakespeare is something that a group can take and make their own, because they are timeless themes. Betrayal, grabbing for power, am I in love with this person, fighting against parental disapproval, those things are timeless, and I think every culture in the world can associate with that.
I'm going to kick the next phone call to Don, and this phone call comes from Susan and Rush, talking about the thing that connected her to Shakespeare. What was it, Susan?
All right, I've got to be honest about this. I was very fortunate to have some incredible teachers at the Harley School, including Michael Lasser, Alex DeSantis, Alan Pavlik. And the way that they got us to pay attention to Shakespeare, which, you know, we read every year, we did a Shakespeare at least once a year, was to clue us into the dirty jokes. You got to, seriously, you've got to meet teenagers where they are. And that was what got us to pay attention, which I thought was, in hindsight, was genius.
Look, if that gets people in the door, right, Susan? I mean, we're talking teenagers here.
Shakespeare is loaded with dirty jokes that a lot of people don't get. And they were like, hey, this is what's going on here. And I thought it was brilliant.
I love that. And you know what? Thank you, Susan. The least surprising thing ever is that Michael Lasser led with the dirty jokes. We love you, Michael Lasser. And I wish I could take classes from the great Michael Lasser. But that's a great point from Susan. But then on the other side of this, Don, we have listeners. Our own Mona Segatola-Slami from Classical says, a different point of view. Why hold up classics or a canon at all? Why not just teach other works? Alternatively, a nice musical example of classics. Orpheus is a new opera. Orpheus and Eurydice is the new opera at the Met. While one of the biggest hits on Broadway is a retelling of that same story, Hadestown. How do you feel about this notion of maybe we don't need it, or if we need it, let's excise the stuff that we find troubling from a modern point of view, Don?
That's a lot there. You always want the source material, and you want to understand source material. You see Steven Spielberg's West Side Story coming out, which was a retelling of Romeo and Juliet. And I believe I just saw something on the Sunday morning where Pat Benatar was doing her own version of Romeo and Juliet with, I think, his old producer. And once you see the source material, you can go wherever you want with it. But you should always, especially with English class, you always want to see where the language comes from, and you hope that that sparks onto something that will build off of it. But you should always, it's kind of like with math, you start with 1 + 1 and then it builds off from there. But if you don't have the foundation, it's hard to jump right in the middle without an appreciation where it came from.
Sheila, where are you on that question of why hold up the classics or a canon at all?
Well, we actually talked about this in all of my classes the other day, because in anticipation of today, I polled my students. And one of the things we talked about is if you read the same books that your parents read or that your grandparents read, you have a conversation. It's a conversation about ideas. Maybe you didn't like the book. Maybe your parents liked the book. But the other thing that I would say is that a canon can be a separator, or a canon can be an equalizer. And a canon shouldn't be thought of as something in concrete. It should be thought of as a continuum. Like, there's room for everything in the canon. We're always looking for newer books to bring in that will connect. Like Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad, we have copies of that. We have Homegoing, which is a new book in AP Lit. That is a wonderful book. And then we can take those books and we can look for themes that were there in older books. So the other thing I was thinking of, too, is I was thinking about the comment that it's that Shakespeare isn't representative of other cultures. But I am an advisor in our school's Shakespeare Club, and we have a competition every year at the English Speaking Union. And students have to memorize a speech. And a couple of years ago, before the pandemic, we had some students who were refugees that were participating. And one of them performed Shylock's speech from The Merchant of Venice, "Prick us, do we not bleed?" And it was very moving because it was very heavily accented. It was not an easy speech for him to read or to memorize, but he did it with such feeling that it was really, he had made it his own. So I think that is, that to me, that was a good example of what Shakespeare can do.
Well, in our last 90 seconds, let me ask Don Burns, are we going to see this film in full here, Don? Is the public going to be able to see the film in which you've got Shakespeare reading Macbeth here?
Yes, we have Darth Vader is doing the Tomorrow and Tomorrow speech, and we are premiering it at Regal Henrietta tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Tickets are at the door, and all Regal Henrietta gave us the auditorium, donated us the auditorium. All proceeds are going to Make-A-Wish, and we're asking for a donation on top of that. If you can't make it out tomorrow night at Regal Henrietta, you can see it. It'll go on YouTube on the YouTube /C/ Tomorrow and Tomorrow 2021 page.
We'll throw up a link there. Once it's up there in a few days, Don, we'll go back, put up a link on the podcast page here.
Okay. And there will be a link on there to donate to the 501st Fund to Make-A-Wish.
And the film is how long, Don?
About 5 minutes.
That's
it. But we have other stuff planned, too.
That's what I mean. So, I mean, it's very well produced, I have to say. So remind people where they can see it tomorrow night, Don.
Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Regal Henrietta.
Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, Regal Henrietta. Darth Vader doing the Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Fun, right, Sheila?
Yes, sounds Why good
not?
To me.
Why not?
Sound and fury.
signifying, well, nada. Nick in Fairport says, I think a modernization of a classic story does more to provide a snapshot of our current culture, which is in turn valuable to future generations. Well said, Nick. Great stuff this hour. Don Burns is an English teacher. Good luck with the film. Have fun tomorrow night, and thanks for being with us, Don.
Thank you.
And Sheila Byrne, AP English teacher at Webster Thomas High School. I want to go back and take your classes.
Well, as long as you don't care about your grade.
Thank you for being here, by the way. Thank you. Rob Braden, Emery Stein, Evan Dawson, Megan Mack saying thank you for listening. And we're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.